This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Simpuga, and here's what's coming up.
So what convened here was a sham parliament voted in by only 11% of voters based on an illegal constitution supported by only 20% of Tunisians.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, explaining why critics say Tunisia's new parliament lacks legitimacy. Also, U.S. Secretary of State is in Niger, and police and demonstrators clashed today in Dakar ahead of a court case involving opposition leader Sonko. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is visiting Niger today in what officials are calling a historic visit after a trip to Ethiopia. Blinken is meeting with Prime Minister Ahmadou Mohamud and Foreign Minister Houssami Massaoudou to discuss humanitarian aid and support. Niger, like other Sahel countries, is grappling with serious challenges such as climate change and threats from Islamic insurgent factions. Reporter Elysia Walkman discussed the likely priorities with Amanda Cadlett, a security analyst for North Africa and the Sahel.
The visit by Secretary Blinken is historic because a U.S. State Department secretary has never made a state visit to Niger. So it's historic in that sense primarily, but also because of the context in which he's arriving. There has been a presence by the United States in Niger for some time militarily, but this is a new era and a new development in the Sahel region because of the presence of Russia's Wagner group throughout the region. It's also historic in a way because Niger has typically been the domain of the French, and the United States has typically deferred to France on its foreign policy there and has been supportive of France in that way. So Secretary Blinken's visit to Niger is historic on several levels, but those would be, I think, the main three.
What key issues will Niger's Prime Minister want to discuss with Blinken?
So Niger right now is in a place of not necessarily domestic instability, but is surrounded by it. So the Nigerian Prime Minister, Mohamedou, is most likely going to discuss a range of security issues with Secretary Blinken. I'm sure that the Nigerian authorities are most concerned about the rise of Wagner Group, as I mentioned, but also a rise in activity by ISIS and Al-Qaeda throughout the region, or Al-Qaeda-linked groups.
Niger is a key security partner of the US, hosting a massive drone base. So in terms of security in the Sahel, why is this visit so important right now?
The US security interest there is beyond just a drone base, which was, it initially started to keep an eye on nefarious actors like ISIS or Al-Qaeda-linked groups throughout the region. But it goes deeper than that too, because, and this is more of a European-centric issue, but migration through 2014, 2013 to 2017, there was an influx of sub-Saharan migration through Niger to Libya, and that acted as a conduit for migrants in their attempts to get to Europe. So a bit entwined with European security more than necessarily just a U.S. security interest. But, naturally now that has expanded because Wagner's presence is so expansive throughout the region. It isn't just Libya or Mali. Wagner Group mercenaries are in a half a dozen countries all over the African continent. Given the current global competition environment, that is the primary interest of the United States.
Blinken says he wants to support projects working with youth in Niger's key conflict zones. Could you explain why this is so important for Niger and the region?
There is a youth bubble that has been building and continues to explode all in Niger. And Niger also has among the lowest levels and rates of youth education in the world. So It would be my guess that youth programs for Niger, sponsored by the United States, are aimed at reducing the potential for young people to have sort of what they call push-pull factors, a push factor being a lack of education and a pull factor by extremist groups to, or violent jihadist groups to pull them into their orbit.
That was Amanda Carletts, a security analyst for North Africa and the Sahel, speaking with reporter Elysia Volkman. Blinken earlier met with top of Ethiopian leaders in an effort to repair damaged ties after the brutal two-year civil war against forces in the northern Tigray region left an estimated 500,000 people dead. Deepening the peace and promoting a transitional justice policy which would seek accountability for atrocities committed by all sides in the conflict was high on the agenda. Tunisia's parliament reconvened Monday for the first time since President Kais Saied suspended it 20 months ago, but neither local nor foreign reporters were allowed to cover it. Security forces told some 50 journalists who had waited outside the building for hours that only public television and the state-run news agency were allowed into entry. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed this development with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawy.
Well, first of all, the parliament was not really reconvened. The 2019 parliament, established under the old constitution, has been illegally blocked from meeting in person by the army since July 2021, but it's still the only legitimate parliament, and it was able to convene virtually in 2022 and vote down all of Kais Saied's laws by presidential decree since the summer of 2021. So what convened here was a sham parliament voted in by only 11% of voters based on an illegal constitution supported by only 20% of Tunisians. And both of those figures are official, but they appear to be inflated. The National Salvation Front, which brings together almost all of the existing Tunisian parties, said abstentions were over 91%. And the main election watchdog, Burak Kibun, said the turnout for those parliamentary elections was closer to 5%, and that 95% of Tunisians had chosen not to vote. These are the first and second round lowest turnouts in contemporary world history elections, you know, since World War II. The only lower one was Jamaica in 1983. And seven seats in this so-called parliament are vacant due to lack of candidates. And the majority of people in parliament had no opponent in the elections. They just are seated because they were the only person who wanted to run. So with 90% of Tunisians excluded, 100% of parties excluded by the constitution, it's only fitting that 100% of non-state media were excluded. You know, why televise a debacle? What the government said was these parliamentarians didn't know each other because they're not from political parties. They're just supporters of the president who don't know each other. So the first session was a get to know you. And then a very confusing thing has to happen. Since they're not allowed political parties, they now have to form blocks. And these are blocks that they can't leave, according to this constitution written by the president himself. So it's sort of confusing whether to even join a grouping that you're not allowed ever to leave at that point and that you didn't run with in the election. So the only people there are the president's supporters. Seven of the seats are vacant, and I think two more were just made vacant because those were illegal parliamentarians, even under this constitution. So this is just a mockery of elections, and the boycotts will continue.
This parliament has been stripped of a lot of its duties. What could this new parliament do as a watching dog for the executive branch?
Pretty much nothing. It's a rubber stamp parliament. It's been stripped of all of its constitutional authorities under the old constitution. Article 3, which is the legislative branch, actually had more powers than the presidency. Article 4, which was relegated primarily the powers of defense and foreign affairs, which is one of the reasons this president seized all of the power of all three branches of government because he felt frustrated, constrained to only controlling two of the executive functions of government. So his result was to write a constitution himself. This parliament has no oversight, no control of budgets, can't remove the president, and is based on a kind of utopian direct democracy model, very similar to Gaddafi's Jamahiriya system that was overthrown in next door Libya in 2011, where basically local municipalities vote for individuals, and then those individuals who all have to support the leader vote for layers of bureaucracy above themselves, leading up to another chamber and national bodies, all of which answer to the president and which the president can remove at will. Again, concentrating all of the popular power into the presidential powers. So that's hardly a system that's ever worked globally when it's been tried, and it won't work in Tunisia.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi. As the world celebrates Women's History Month, women say it's increasingly unsafe to live in South Africa, with thousands raped, assaulted, and killed each year. President Cyril Ramaphosa has admitted that not enough has been done to protect them. Thuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
According to the latest crime statistics, over 12,000 women were raped between October and December 2022. Close to 6,000 were raped at the residence of the perpetrator. Hundreds were also killed over the same period, while others were victims of assault with intent to cause grievous bodily harm. This has left many South African women worried. Nelly Nechitenze is a mother of two who resides in Johannesburg. She told VOA that it is sad to hear that so many women die in the hands of people they trust.
Most women are being killed by their husband because they have nowhere to go, because they're depending on those husbands, because they are the one that provides. So just go to school, or even if you can no longer go to school, try to start a business, try to have something that belongs to you, something that you will use to provide for your children.
Corence Mokwasi-Ncube, a Zimbabwean national living in Johannesburg, told VOA that migrant women are also being victimized.
It is very bad. The gender-based violence is too much, and it's done and caused by men in most cases. We are crying out loud, please, no to gender-based violence.
In his State of the Nation address this year, and the annual presidential gender summit held last year, President Cyril Ramaphosa admitted that not enough has been done to protect women.
Despite our efforts, violence against women and children continues unabated in our country. Not a day goes by without a story in our newspapers, on television, and online platforms about a woman or a child that has lost their life or been abused in the most horrendous manner.
Zanele Ncwane, a provincial manager at the Gender Commission, told VOA that solutions are urgently needed.
The establishment of the National Council on Gender-Based Violence, we believe, will bring change to the situation that we are faced with. A council that will be resourced financially and with a relevant, well-trained personnel.
Resolutions agreed upon at the Presidential Gender Summit agreed that it was now very urgent for the whole country to stand up and confront the scourge. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Thuso Kumalo.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Eighteen people were killed in Burkina Faso in attacks by Islamic extremists Monday. Witnesses and a security official told the French news agency AFP that seven civilians were killed in the village of Tayobin in central eastern Balgu province. Another 11 were killed the same day in two attacks in the northern province of Larum. Authorities say security forces killed 20 of the assailants. Burkina Faso has been fighting Islamic extremists since 2015 in a conflict that has killed more than 10,000 civilians, troops and police, and displaced at least 2 million people. About 40% of the country is under the control of the militants. Mozambique President Filipe Nyusi says the death toll in the country from Cyclone Freddy has jumped to 53, with nearly 50,000 people displaced by the record-breaking storm, which killed more than 225 in neighboring Malawi. Charles Mwangiro reports from Maputo, Mozambique.
In a state TV address Wednesday night, President Filipe Nyusi said the cyclone-related death in Mozambique were caused by drownings, electrocutions, fires, falling walls and trees, and lightning. Nyusi said the city of Kilimani was the worst affected by Cyclone Freddy, with 50,000 people displaced from destroyed and damaged homes to more than 130 centers with temporary shelters. He said more than 1,500 classrooms and 52 clinics were destroyed in Zambezia province, the most affected. In an audio recording of the address sent to the media, the Mozambican president said 250 security personnel were dispatched for rescue operations and nearly $4 million earmarked to support recovery efforts. He says for this, Mozambique will have a permanent post-cyclone reconstruction office. Secondly, says Nyusi, an assessment of the damage caused should be immediately carried out and followed by the mobilization of internal and external resources for the recovery or reconstruction of the affected districts in the province of Zambezia. Nyusi said the record cyclone had cut roads and power to some areas, and continuing rains were hampering search and rescue efforts in the six affected provinces. Freddy hit Mozambique for a second time Saturday, becoming one of the longest-lasting tropical cyclones ever recorded since first making landfall in February in Madagascar. The cyclone, which has since lowered in intensity to a tropical storm, dumped heavy rains across Mozambique and Malawi, causing severe flooding that swept away roads and bridges and buried houses under thick mud. Tens of thousands were left homeless and scores remain missing, meaning the death toll is certain to rise. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
Funerals are being held in Malawi as the government and aid organizations struggle to aid to get aid survivors of Cyclone Freddy, which battered the country for days. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with the reporter Lameka Masina, who spoke from an evacuation center in the Nachot Elementary School in a Blantyre neighborhood hard hit by the storm. About 1,600 evacuees, including hundreds of children, are there. Some told Lameka aid is not getting through fast enough and that yesterday some had just one meal. Clean water also is in short supply.
And even clean water, although there are just one bowser from the I think from UKAID, which is providing clean water, but they say it is not enough at the moment. So the general view is that the situation is still bad. And one of the contributing factors is because the roads are very impassable. Only the 4x4s are getting in here. So those people who have made assistance, some sort of assistance like clothes, those communities surrounding them, they can't come here because the roads are too bad.
He says the government is still trying to reach those harmed by the storm.
Now the number of displaced is at 19,000 and more. Because the houses are still collapsing, so the figure would still rise. The number of casualties are now at about 255. Those who are dead, these are the people who have died so far. But because now, as I'm talking to you, rescue and search operations are underway, and the military is still recovering some dead bodies from the house that have been destroyed so far.
President Lazarus Chakwera yesterday visited three evacuation centers and attended the funeral of 28 storm victims.
So thereafter, President Chair will have declared 14 days of mourning for those who have been killed. He said these 14 days they will be used to maybe coordinate any efforts. For example, he asked the non-government organizations, some aid agencies, maybe during this period, to be distributing, to intensify their efforts in assisting those who have been displaced.
Lameka reports President Chakwera says he will ask neighboring Zambia to lend Malawi helicopters to get aid to cut-off areas. And Lameka says many Malawians are mobilizing to help their neighbors, with a group of Land Rover owners carrying supplies to evacuation areas. At the center where he was, dozens of 4x4 cars were coming in with aid. Plumes of smoke and tear gas drifted into the sky of Dakar today as police clashed with opposition protesters. It marked the third day of unrest in Senegal's capital, where opposition leader Ousmane Sonko is facing trial for alleged defamation. Anika Hamashlak reports from Dakar.
Hundreds of protesters surrounded the car taking Sonko to the courthouse as police and riot gear encircled the area. Just before the officers dispersed the crowd with tear gas, Sonko stepped out of the vehicle to send a message. He said, "It's the police that are preventing me from moving. It's the police that have prevented me from getting to my hearing. This is Senegal. The face of Senegal is the dictatorship of Macky, with police repression." He was referring to President Macky Sall. A police spokesperson was not immediately available to comment on the allegation. Sall's refusal to state whether he'll run for an unconstitutional third term in next year's elections has incensed many Senegalese. His administration has also been widely accused of silencing dissent through arbitrary arrests. Senegal's government denies persecuting the opposition or moving away from democracy. Sonko is facing libel charges for allegedly accusing tourism minister Mame Mbaye Niang of embezzlement. Sonko also faces separate charges for rape, which his supporters say were fabricated to prevent him from running for the presidency. Sonko has denied these allegations. His arrest a year ago ignited a week of rioting that led to the deaths of 14 people. No deaths have been reported in this latest round of protests, but violence on Thursday was widespread. Demonstrators hurled rocks at police, burned down grocery stores, and destroyed bus depots. They hauled parked cars onto streets to act as roadblocks and smashed windows. Paulin Maurice Toupin is a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies in Dakar. Senegal, he says, is at a tipping point. Senegal must do everything it can to avoid reaching the level of instability we see in other countries in the region, he says. West Africa has suffered a series of coups in the last few years, and instability in Senegal, long considered the region's most solid democracy, could ripple beyond its borders. Tensions are only expected to grow as the country gets closer to the presidential election in February 2024. Sonko came in third in the 2019 presidential election and has since grown in popularity, mainly among Senegalese youth. 26-year-old Mohamed Diako was among the protesters.
I'm very sad, you know, in this situation in our country. I'm so sad. I'm not happy what is happening. I got this shame inside of me. I got this anger inside of me because, you know, we people, Senegalese people, we don't deserve that. We don't deserve that. We deserve the peace. We deserve love.
A rally for Sonko on Tuesday drew an estimated 10,000 supporters. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Season 3 of the Basketball Africa League is here. Starting off in Dakar from March 11th to March 21st for the Sahara Conference, then heading to Cairo from April 26th to May 6th for the Nile Conference, and the excitement continues to build in the finals in Kigali from May 21st to May 27th. Tune in and follow the BAL on The Voice of America.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbill Yeborah, and our engineer tonight, Bill Adrede, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.